The oral history interview with Mrs. Ernestine Robinson, conducted by Tina Jones. Okay, I first want to ask you about your childhood and how it was growing up in a segregated South.
Well, it was. But so.
Imagine if you grew up where you could not drink water downtown and you could not try clothes on in stores. You could buy them, but you couldn't try them on. And if you tried them on, you couldn't take them back to exchange them. So you had to know exactly what you wore in order to get any benefit out of it. I can remember, like, plus this is the holiday season, going shopping, and we shopped at the commissary. It's my father worked at Tennessee Coal and Iron, and they had their own store. And you could buy anything in the store. Oh, clothing, food, shoes, farming equipment, grain, chicken feed. It was an all-encompassed store. Commissary then denoted anything that the workers needed, they provided, because part of that probably was thrown back into the company. So they really were making profit twice, paying the worker, and then the worker paying them back for the goods that they provided, which in many instances to me was like indentured servitude. And it took a long time for that to set in, because we really thought that was a great thing, because we always wore nice clothes and we ate good food. We lived in very decent housing, which was not provided by TCI, but everybody in my community, which was, I thought, and still do think, was a middle-class community. We had black doctors, black postmaster, black school teachers, black preachers, but the oddity, people who made money within the community, were white. Mr. Charlie had his store in a community called Annisburg, and he had a daughter named Bessie. And Bessie, on the cloaks, dated and had liaison with black men, simply because there were no other men besides her brother who came into the community. Mm-hmm. And it was like an unspoken type relationship that existed, and invisible. They act as though it did not go on, but it did go on. She never, as girls are doing today, she never had black children, but she had several liaisons with men. And this lasted up until they left. And Mr. Charlie sold Bologna. He would sell a nickel's worth, a dime's worth. He had his little tablet, and you can get bread and a chicken and all of the food. Now that I recollect, never looked really fresh, but it was all on ice. And of course, that wasn't the kind of refrigeration you have today. It was actually real ice in the cases. The boxes were not electric. They were boxes that held ice. And on top of the ice were items that you bought which would spoil. And then the peas and beans were packaged, and the cookies were in a jar. People just put their hand in the jar and counted out the number of cookies they wanted, mm-hmm. and paid for them. And nobody ever thought about it being not hygienic. Mm-hmm. It was an accepted practice in the South. This is the same thing with suckers and jawbreakers and peppermint balls, licorice. And one of my favorite foods was the sugar cane, and my daddy, that was our treat. And he would buy us the long stalks of sugar cane, and we would strip them and you chew them down to the all the sweet inside of them, and then you pour it away, and they look like chewed straw. One of my favorite childhood delicacies at that time. And when we, Mr. Charlie, we could walk to his store, and we could get an orange and two oatmeal cookies and a bar of candy for a nickel. I mean, that seems almost unbelievable to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that was our treat usually on Saturdays. We did that. I don't think he ever followed people around the store. It is not, at this time, I can't recollect whether or not he was conspicuous of blacks being in his store, because all of his customers, unless somebody happened to venture into that area, because it was a totally black community, and he stayed open Monday through late afternoon Saturdays. And in that store you could buy hose to wear to church on Sundays, and you could buy women personal items. It was an all-encompassing store if you didn't get it at the commissary when you went for your visit there. And in the commissary they had books, coupons, which are very, very similar to, I guess, I'm not familiar with food stamps, but I'm sure this is the way it was. And you would spend the books. You were allotted according to how many years your father worked at the coal plant, at the steel plant, rather. So many books. And then when you had used up your allowance, you were not allowed to get credit anymore, because the payment came from his paycheck, and they would take out so much per month for what you spent. And like if there was a layoff, then there was very little you could get there, and those were very, very lean times. I can remember that. And there were quite a few strikes. I can recall my daddy saying one time there was a man who was not white, but who would be listed as white, working at the steel plant, and they had gone earlier to pick up their pay. When they got back into the plant, there were blowers, and the blowers blew part of his paycheck out of his hand way over into the furnace, and the man never hesitated. He just jumped, and he was burned to a crisp. And at that time, that was to show you, which is more significant today, the value of a piece of paper. And I guess he never thought he wouldn't catch his money, and he never thought about the danger entailed. Mm-hmm. So he jumped. And they had a funny way of working. Black, it was totally segregated, and the dirty work, the stoking of the coals and the furnaces, the working clothes, where the danger was, that's where the black men worked. No women were allowed in the plants. And the cleaner jobs, which may be same thing as now, since I know very little about plants in the first place, the dangerous jobs, the dirty jobs, the jobs where I can remember vividly my father coming home covered with filaments, dirt, dust from head to toe. It was a ritual in my home. The ritual was that as soon as he came to the back door, he would pull off his work shoes, pull off his jacket, and that would be residue. Little piles of residue left from where he shook those things and beat his boot on the side of the house. And then he would come in and take off the rest of the things that he worked in. Obviously, it must have been either cold, or they were protective covering, because he wore like a union suit and work pants and another pair of work pants and a jacket. It's hard to imagine people working and getting around and doing that. And I think that the pay at that time was something like $2.75 an hour, which was phenomenal. People thought that was a lot of money at that time. It possibly was.
Mm-hmm.
And people had the old saying, you know, if you worked at TC&I, you know, you had the greatest job in the world. Probably reminiscent of when Henry Ford raised the put his workers on hourly pay and gave them the highest salary that had been paid in America at the time. I think that's the way people felt in Fairfield, because it was a steel producing giant. And there were railroads, and the railroads never went through the black communities. I always remember that vividly. All of the danger entailed, all of the smoke and the soot was around the black folks' houses. It was on the outskirts of the towns, and of course the towns demographically were built where blacks lived, on the outskirts. People walked like into town to clean up for white people, and then they would journey back in the afternoons to the all black segregated areas, which primarily I can remember lots of people being killed by the railroads. And I can remember playing on the railroad track, and we used to get the flashes. That's not exactly what they were called. It escapes me now. But they were red, and you could light them, and they would give off a light. And we thought that was like one of the most magnificent things we had. And it would give off a sulfur smell. And these were the devices that men held to warn trains and to stop them and stuff like that. And sometimes when they were not entirely burned, they would throw them down. And once thrown down, they would go out, and we would go and get them. And we would play, you know, like stopping trains and things. And that was one of my favorite pastimes. It really was. I was baptized by Reverend R.A. Anderson, who is deceased like my mother and my father. And I thought Reverend Anderson was the greatest minister I had to this day that I have ever known. And we were put on the mourner's bench. And on the mourner's bench, you were a sinner. And it was like you could not leave church after the week of revival if you had not received salvation. And it was funny to see that word. And I can remember vividly being real scared. And they would preach, and then people would come, and they'd put the hands on you, and they would beg the Lord to deliver you from sin, cleanse your heart, and come into our hearts. And I think it was more terrifying than it was anything. I think that the majority of the children who joined church out of being tired of them praying over them and being tired of being on the mourner's bench, because you had to stay on the mourner's bench. It was mandatory. Until you had received salvation, you didn't have a reprieve. And the first 3 nights, you know, it wasn't this pressure. But as it wound up, the revival and the praying over you and the touching and the begging you to come off of the mourner's bench and receive Jesus Christ became more obvious. And they were sincere, because this is this was a black practice. And as now that I recall, it probably needs to be done today, because there is no fear of what happens to one when one has not been saved, when one is out, quote, the ark of safety. And you're, quote, out of the ark of safety if you have not verbally accepted Jesus Christ as the whole encompassed person in your life. Everything else is secondary. Everything that you do, every goodness that happens to you, every badness that's happened to you, you got to be strong enough to withstand the bad. But you know that Christ resides within you, and that the world, as an old black hymn says, the world can't do you no harm once you've been converted. And I believe that, and in real essence, I still do, that the world really can't do you any harm if you're right, and if you're convicted, if you've been washed in the blood, if you've accepted Jesus as your Savior. And that maybe the drinking and the carousing, maybe the fornication or the adultery that you do in your lifetime, because we're human beings and subject to error, all of this is washed away because we've already been saved. And the only thing that we have to do is ask that we be forgiven for the sins that we have committed, if they are not the sins for which we will not be forgiven. There are sins that the Bible says we will not be forgiven for.